Funding for THINK comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the world's best developed economies grow so addicted to debt? And what will happen now that many appear unlikely to pay their creditors back in full? Since ancient times, the great story of economics has been one of conflict between borrowers and lenders, but they've been able to collaborate successfully when both parties felt confident that debtors would have more money in the future than they have in the present. But as my guest today will tell us, that confidence has eroded greatly over the past several years, leaving creditor nations like China with greater power but also greater liability as Western nations struggle to pay back what they owe. Philip Coggan is Buttonwood columnist for The Economist and former investment editor for The Financial Times. His new book is called Paper Promises, Debt, Money, and the New World Order. He'll be in town tomorrow for an address to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can find information at dfwworld.org. Philip, welcome to THINK.
Thank you very much for having me, Chris.
You start this book, interestingly, with a brief history of money itself. Why is that such an important baseline for understanding where we are today?
Well, two reasons, Chris. First of all, money and debt are very closely related. So back in the old days, money was gold and silver. So if you had gold and silver, it was no one else's liability. It was just yours. But nowadays, the money we use is largely somebody else's debt. So our credit card or debit card is a claim on the bank. The second thing is that you can see the history that you very well outlined before I came on, this history of battle between borrowers and lenders. Debtors and creditors, as a battle over the nature of money, with the borrowers wanting more money to be created and the lenders wanting the supply of money to be restricted. And so one person who features a lot in the book is William Jennings Bryan, who ran for president three times in 1896, 1904, 1908. And he made this great speech. He was kind of the Barack Obama of the late 19th century. He was a powerful orator, a senator from a Midwest state. And he said, "You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." And what that was about was that he was representing the farmers. The farmers had debts. The farmers wanted silver to be added to the money supply to create some inflation and get rid of their debts. And that was William Jennings Bryan's great campaign. So this issue, you know, it's not new. It's not something that's just cropped up since 2008. It's resonated all the way through history.
It is interesting, too. We take currency so completely for granted and the symbolic nature of what money is that it's interesting to step back and think about its invention required a sort of psychological leap for everybody involved.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the first people really to use paper money were the Chinese. From about the 9th century to the 15th century. And Marco Polo, who is the great traveler who went over there, he was just astonished that you could use paper money instead of gold and silver. He thought, why should anybody accept it? And the reason was that the authority of the Grand Khan, who was it was a Mongol empress like Genghis Khan at the time, the authority of those emperors was so strong that people almost dared not refuse the money. And that nature of money is so tied up with our faith in the government. If you go to countries where the faith in the government breaks down, like Zimbabwe in recent years, for example, or, of course, Germany in the 1920s, then, of course, money tends to lose its value. And we're seeing a struggle, of course, in Europe at the moment where countries have given up their right to have their own money, and we're now starting to doubt whether Greece and the other countries can pay their debts because, of course, they can't just create money out of thin air anymore in the case of Greece. They have to rely on that they are restricted from doing that. So this whole business of what gives money value, why do we accept paper money? Because the government stands behind it. Why do we accept bank money? Because governments stand behind banks. So it's all about faith in government.
So if there is no faith in government, there is no solution to the problems we have right now.
No, well, this is why the crisis has loomed so large. So if you go back 3 or 4 years when Lehman collapsed and suddenly governments had to rescue the banking system, some governments found it, you know, relatively easy to do that, but some governments were completely overwhelmed. Iceland, for example, the banks were 8 or 10 times the size of the economy. Ireland was another example, and they needed rescuing. And if you then start to doubt whether the government itself can meet its debts, which is clearly the case in Greece and Portugal, then, of course, you have a huge crisis, and you need loans from outside governments to keep the whole thing going.
How did we get so comfortable in the industrialized world with taking on debt from other countries?
I think it's all stems from the early 1970s. Now, up until 1971, there was some link to gold. The proper gold standard had disappeared, really, in the 1930s. But there was a system called Bretton Woods, which came in after the Second World War, and all currencies were linked to the dollar, and the dollar was linked to gold. And so there was a kind of limit in that system, and the amount of new money that could be created, because countries couldn't risk their exchange rates by having, you know, too big a spree. But after that period, there was no constraint, really, on the creation of money or debt altogether. And after 1971 also coincided with one of the most rapid growths in population that the world has ever seen, with the entry of new, of course, countries into the global economy like China and India, which had previously been cut out of the capitalist system. So we had this long boom, and we had a long boom characterized by lots of lending against assets, particularly property. And everybody felt good about it because you bought a house with a loan. The house went up in price, so the bank was happy. You were happy, and that encouraged you to buy a bigger house. And the whole system worked and worked and worked, and we got more debt, higher asset prices, until really the whole thing came to a shuddering halt in 2007.
You mentioned population a moment ago, and this is a really big deal here in terms of what stands in the way of timely repayment. Not only do many debtor nations lack funds at the moment, they are dealing with aging and even shrinking populations, meaning potential GDP growth is greatly limited.
You're absolutely right, Chris. So that's a big problem, particularly in Europe. In Europe, in many countries, the population is set to fall and the working population is set to particularly fall. So the baby boomers, people like me who were born between 1946 and 1964, we're coming up to retirement within the next 10 or 15 years and just starting to retire many people. And we haven't had as many children as our generation. So you're seeing, you know, fertility rates in Europe of often 1.3, 1.4 births per adult female, so much less than replacement rates. And as a consequence, we've got fewer workers for every retiree, and that is a burden on the economy. And economic growth is made up really of two things. You either have more workers or you make the workers work better, which is called productivity improvements. And if you have fewer workers, you need a awful lot of productivity to make up for that. And it's very unlikely that we'll grow fast. And the best way to get out of a debt crisis is to grow fast. That's what countries did after the Second World War, but it's much more difficult for them to do that now.
Why is immigration so controversial given the realities that that Europe is facing right now in particular?
Well, it's a good question. Again, I think if you look back to the history of America, I mean, the whole history of America has been built on its ability to assimilate immigrants and turn from a nation which was, you know, only a few million back in the 18th century, of course, to 300 million today. But Europe is having a different, really, experience of immigration from American one, whereas much of the early immigration to America was from Europeans, you know, the Italians, the Irish. Of course, in Europe, the most likely source of immigration is from North Africa, and there the cultural issues are coming up. So there are plenty of anti-immigrant parties in Europe which are very suspicious of immigration. So that's the difficulty. And, of course, Japan is another economy with a very poor demography. It's aging very rapidly. And Japan has very little immigration. So, again, they're not making it any easier for themselves to grow their way out of the debt because they are limiting the number of people who can come into the country.
So let's talk about this belief that we all developed in the industrialized world that you mentioned earlier, that you could buy real estate and sort of count on it as an almost guaranteed investment. Essentially, we thought we could create wealth without actually doing anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's very bizarre, isn't it?
It's a nice idea.
Yeah, absolutely. There's an old parable about the desert island where everybody got rich by taking in their neighbor's washing. Right? And it's a bit like that with house prices. How can we possibly all get rich by buying and selling each other's houses? Who are we selling them to? My father-in-law asked me a very good question in the middle of the crisis. He said, you know, the stock market had fallen by whatever it was, $1 trillion in value. He said, where did that money go? Well, the answer is, of course, it was never really there. Bernie Madoff is a good example. You know, Bernie Madoff said he had $65 billion under management. And really, he never put most of that money to work. He was just telling people they had more money. He only ever got $15 billion or so. So it's just like that with houses. We can all trade them amongst each other and push up the price. But if we all wanted to sell at once, clearly we'd never get that price. So the value of them depends just on confidence that that price will go up further. Once that confidence disappears, you have to base house prices on something more rational, and that's the amount we earn. And of course, our earnings were going up nothing like as fast as house prices in the 1990s and early 2000s. And we've seen in the last few years what's happened is reality has dawned, and house prices are falling back to where they should be relative to how much we earn.
So we have China now in this relatively recent role as creditor to the world. What sort of power does that debt give to China? And on the other side of the coin, what sort of liability does China have now?
Yeah, it's a bit like mutually assured destruction in the Cold War. So China owns a lot of American treasury bonds. And if America defaults on those treasury bonds, then China's in trouble because it loses a lot of money. On the other hand, China is acting like the banker to America. So it's like you don't really want to annoy your banker if you have an overdraft or a loan coming due. So you have to tread very carefully. So it's worked as a system reasonably well up to now. The trouble is, you know, the pile of money that China is accumulating is getting higher and higher. They have $3.2 trillion of foreign exchange reserves. That's more than they could possibly need. And they also have a population, many of whom are very poor, who would like to see the money spent at home. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very hard to see how that relationship can continue with America always running deficits and China always financing them, especially when China's only earning, what, a couple of percent on treasury bonds at the moment. So that's why I think in not next year, but there will be a crisis, just as there was in the 1930s when we had lots of debts, in the 1970s when we fixed exchange rate system broke down. We're heading for another crisis where the whole order gets remade. And when that world order gets remade, then the creditor country tends to write the rules. So it was Britain who wrote the rules in the 19th century, America in the 20th century, and that's why I think it will be China in the 21st.
What factors beyond domestic demand are most likely to cause China to pull the rug out from countries that are currently living off the credit it's extended to them?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. First of all, I don't know whether you read, there was a Xinhua news agency from China which put out a statement after America got downgraded by Standard & Poor's. Mm. And it basically was a long lecture to America on how, you know, you can't go on like this and that you need to get your act together. So there is a general lack of public tolerance in China for the authorities to keep putting their money into American treasury bonds. Tim Geithner gave a speech in Beijing, and he said, when he said to the students, the U.S. treasury bonds are safe in your hands, the audience laughed. So there's a resistance there. So at some point, there may be domestic political pressure saying, you know, why are we doing this? The second thing is there could obviously be political tensions. The U.S. has just reoriented its defense spending towards Asia, and that's something that's resented by the Chinese. There are still territorial disputes in the Pacific, and there's, of course, the issue of Taiwan, which someday might flare up. Where the America would like to defend the independence of Taiwan, and the Chinese would very much resent that. So it's hard to believe we will get through another decade without some crisis emerging in this process. Because, you know, could we really imagine that in 10 years' time, China earned $10 trillion in reserves? I don't think so.
Philip Coggan is my guest. He's Buttonwood columnist for The Economist and author of the new book Paper Promises, Debt, Money, and the New World Order. He'll be in town tomorrow speaking to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Forgive me, that's Friday. If you would like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Philip Coggan. He's Buttonwood columnist for The Economist and former investment editor of the Financial Times. His new book is called Paper Promises, Debt, Money, and the New World Order. He'll be in town Friday for an address to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can find details online at dfwworld.org. If you'd like to join this conversation, we have lines open right now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, Philip, what happens to those credit-dependent economies if and when China simply cuts off access to additional capital?
Well, it would be enormously difficult. You only have to look at what's happened to Greece, which has essentially been cut off by the markets. At that point, you suddenly have to, instead of borrowing, 9 or 10% of GDP, as some developed countries are every year, suddenly balance your budget unless you get some other form of aid. And that means lots of tax rises, lots of cuts in spending, which countries don't tend to like. And this is a fundamental problem. It's a fundamental problem with democracies, I think. People have tended to vote for policies that require more spending and not vote for higher taxes. And you can't square that circle unless you borrow particularly often from overseas. And then they tend to complain if the markets speculate against them. Well, of course, there's no requirement for other countries to lend to us at a given rate. They do it because they find it attractive, or they don't find it attractive. And if they don't find it attractive, it's no good lecturing them. You have to make your economy more attractive so people will invest money. So this is exactly the problem facing Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal at the moment.
On the other hand, doesn't China need the West to be able to afford its products in order to fuel its own economic growth?
It does. You're right. And that's why they put up with it so far up to now. But there is a great pressure in China to move away from this sort of export-led model of sending exports overseas and to a more domestic model. There's very many poor people in China living on, a dollar a day or similar. And there are many people who would like to see facilities be built at home. There is a lot of poverty, a lot of missing infrastructure in China, particularly away from the coastal regions, and people would like to see the money be shifted to those things rather than just invested in treasury bonds. So China is trying to shift to its model. The question is whether America and, of course, the rest of the developed world can shift at the same time.
What are the consequences of broad-based debt cancellation?
Well, this is a concept which is very old. That's one of the things I hadn't realized when I was researching the book. You know the word jubilee?
Mm-hmm.
My queen is having her jubilee right now, 60 years.
Congratulations.
Yes, exactly. God bless her. And the jubilee in Jewish tradition was an event every 50 years where all debts were canceled.
Hmm.
And it was a way of wiping the slate clean and starting all over again. And I think it's interesting that we've had debt crisis sort of once every 40 years over the last century. Perhaps there's something significant about that period. But of course, in those days, it was a much less complex economy. Let's say we all cancelled our debts tomorrow. Might sound good, and a lot of indebted people would cheer. But of course, that means that the banks who have assets, which are the loans to us, would suddenly find that those assets were worthless. So the banks would need rescuing, which means the governments would have to pump money into the banks, just like they did in 2008, which means the governments would have to take on more debt. So, as a national economy, we'd be back where we started. Now, is it the case that, let's say, we cancelled all the debt to China, for example? Well, would China be willing to lend us any more money if we cancelled all their debts? And that's been a problem with national bankruptcies in the past. No, you'd have to balance your budget immediately. So it sounds good to cancel all the debts, but in practice it would mean that you'd have to change your economic model very, very severely and very, very quickly.
So one of the options available, we should say all the options are bad when people can't pay their debts. There is economic growth that will allow us to sort of earn our way out of this. There is inflation, there is stagnation, and there is outright default.
Yeah.
Not a single good option among them.
Well, the growth is a good one. And, if you want to have an optimistic note about it, then America is in the best position, really, of the developed nations for that. The demography of America is better. You have had more immigration. It's a younger population. It's a very vibrant capitalist society. New industries are being created in software, in biotechnology, in alternative energy, and you've got this great boost that seems to be coming through of shale gas, which is making America less dependent on foreign energy. So if there's one country that can make it through, it's America. But for the other options, yes, Japan has been going through the stagnation for the last 20 years. Economy has barely grown. Debt is very high proportion of GDP and hasn't come down. Greece is defaulting. It's not paying its foreign private creditors. And then there is inflation. And many people think that this process of money creation, which the central banks call quantitative easing, will lead to inflation in the long run. And that's a way of getting rid of the debt in real terms. There's a guy called Dionysus of Syracuse, who features in the book. What he did was he took in all the coins in existence, which were one drachma back then, stamped them all two drachma, used half of the money to pay off his debts, and then gave everybody the money back. It was a brilliant scheme for whatever it was, 800 BC. But of course, it just meant that all the money was worth half what it was before. So that's a way of getting rid of your debts, but it has its own economic problems because very high inflation can lead to economic chaos, just as deep recessions lead to economic chaos.
And devaluing the currency is the worst possible thing you can do for those who have sort of followed the rules all along and taken care of their money.
Yes, exactly. One of my very old colleagues who I respected said to me the other day that savers ought to beware because they are the people with the money and they're the only people you can take it from to deal with this problem. So what's happening to savers at the moment? They're getting what on their money market funds? Sort of barely anything. And yet inflation is still 3% or so. So they are losing money in real terms. They're getting barely anything on their treasury bonds. So this is a way of penalizing savers for being prudent and rewarding borrowers. But alas, it's always the way in these crises that countries bend over backwards to help out borrowers and penalize savers as a result.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Philip Coggan is my guest. We're talking this hour about his new book, Paper Promises, Debt, Money, and the New World Order. First on the phones this afternoon, we have Paul in Richardson. Hello, Paul.
Hi. When I was a kid, we had this story. There was a lot of stories about money and the like, and one was about the grasshopper and the ant. Mm. And the ant did a lot of work and stuff during his time, and then the grasshopper was flying all over the place. But then when it was time in the winter for the for the grasshopper to eat, there was nothing there for him. We used to have those kind of stories along with stories, other things about thrift. We used to have layaway plans. We used to have all kinds of things in this country that dealt with the issue of thrift. But it seems as though we kind of got away from that when we talked about the consumer and the person and the consumer being such a big part of the economy. But when we started talking about the consumer, we were generally also talking about the massive amounts of debt for the consumer to be able to consume. It wasn't about layaway plans. It wasn't about thrift. And so it seems to me that there's this big cycle that goes on, and it could be. I mean, I'm sure that your guest has studied this cycle, where it's really a kind of a swing between the savers and the spenders, the savers and the spenders. Whether they're in the United States, we are the national economy, we save more, therefore we can lend. Now we've spent, and it's over in China. Who can be they are the savers, and now they can lend.
Well, let's get a response for you, Paul, because I think you've put a lot on the table, and I appreciate your call. What do you think about all that, Philip?
I think that's a brilliant summary of the theme of my book, and I appreciate Paul for putting it that way. I mean, one thing that I mentioned in the book is the different moral attitudes towards saving and spending. So if you go back to the novels of Charles Dickens, there's Wilkins Micawber, who's in David Copperfield. He is the guy who says, you know, annual income £20, annual expenditure £20 and sixpence, result misery. And back then you got thrown in prison if you were in debt and you couldn't make your debts. Now, all that changed over time. My father grew up in the 1930s. He didn't believe in having debt because he'd seen what would happen if you had debts in the 1930s. But everything changed in the last 50 years or so because we had inflation, which meant that if you did have debts, generally they got eroded. If you borrowed money to buy a house, you know, you made out because house prices all went up. And you had, you know, a long boom with a growing population, all of which tends to favor borrowers. But I think we will see a change in attitude now, not least because people have already too much debt. if you're a student coming out of university now, you have your college loans. It's going to be more difficult for you to get credit to buy a house. You probably don't expect years and year after year of wage rises as we used to. And so people's attitude towards saving and spending will change. You're exactly right, Paul. This is just the sort of cycle that occurs. And probably in 10 or 20 years' time, we'll be thinking of a sort of thrifty generation, more like people in the 30s and 40s, and less like the baby boomers in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Has home ownership been as officially encouraged by the governments of the UK and the rest of Europe as it has in the United States?
It varies between countries, Chris. In Britain, yes, home ownership is very prevalent. And we used to have this subsidized state housing called council housing. Mrs. Thatcher sold a lot of those houses to the owners as a way of kind of cementing support for the Conservative Party. But in somewhere like Germany, you've only got 30-40% of people who are homeowners. You didn't have a house price boom at all. And there's much more encouragement to the rented sector. And the reason that economists tend to quite like the rented sector is that it's much easier for workers to move. So if you own a house in, I don't know, Detroit, and there are better jobs in Dallas at the moment, then it's very hard for you to sell your house in Detroit because the market's so depressed and move to Dallas where the jobs are. So that's a problem. Whereas if you were renting in Detroit, you could just let your lease expire and disappear. So economists are not as keen on home ownership as politicians tend to be.
Is that at least in part an explanation for why Germany is doing better than many of its neighbors?
In part. They're more like Paul's ant than the grasshopper. I think that's the other thing. Germany has been pretty good at its savings rate. It's also been extremely good at keeping its manufacturing sector strong and exporting to Asia. And that's the key. They did have a deep recession in 2008 when world trade collapsed, but they bounced right back. And Germany's doing much better than most other European countries. And that's why they tend to feel they can lecture other European countries about what they should do. But that does cause a bit of resentment in the likes of Greece, I'm afraid.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we speak with Seth in Fort Worth. Hello, Seth.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Sure. Great. Thank you.
My question is, so I am a young man living in Texas. I'm 25 years old, and I've never had to steward my assets, my savings, through an event like what your guest hinted at, where there would be essentially a rewriting of the rules. And he had suggested that China would be the writer of those rules. And so I was curious, sort of on a practical financial investment type level, what you would recommend for people to do with their money to insulate themselves from the effects of this event.
Okay, well, I'm not sure what the laws are in the States. So I know in Britain I'm not licensed to give investment advice, so I have to be very careful about that, saying practically what you should do. Let me just briefly say what I think will happen, which is that I think there'll be a deal between China and the U.S. eventually, where China agrees to let its currency appreciate perhaps a certain amount a year, and the U.S. agrees to limit its deficit. So that's how I see an agreement coming out eventually, which is sort of similar to the old Bretton Woods system, which lasted for 25 years or so. So it would be more of a managed exchange rate. What do I think the individual should do? I mean, if the individual can diversify their portfolio, this is common sense. You should be, I think, very cautious at the moment of owning fixed income securities that earn very little, because there is the danger of inflation in the future. And people should be thinking about having a portfolio that is globally exposed rather than just exposed to their home country. You look at the developing countries, they have much less debt relative to GDP than the developed. And that didn't used to be the case. It used to be we always had crises in the likes of Latin America. But nowadays, it's Latin America, places like Brazil are doing very well, and places like Europe are doing very badly. So you should be thinking about which are the coming powers in the world and exposing your savings to those powers rather than the old world, particularly in Europe.
Interesting email here from Paul in Farmers Branch, who writes, do we need to have continuous growth to have a vibrant economy? And is it possible to have continuous growth?
And very good question indeed. Well, it's been possible for the last 400 years, pretty much in Britain. You've had this long period of growth. Up until 1700, the economies barely grew at all. And the interesting question is why things changed. And part of the answer, which is in the book, is about how we changed the use of energy. So up until 1700, we had our energy depended really on what humans could do and what animals could do, mm-hmm. and a bit of burning wood. Then we started to use carbon fuels, first coal, and then later on, of course, gas and oil. And that's been just a huge improvement. The sort of there was a very good example that somebody gave me. Just imagine instead of driving your car 30 miles, you had to push it. It would take you a very long time. You would be exhausted quite quickly. So that's a huge improvement in sort of productivity. Now, if we run out into some constraint on the amount of energy we can use, or if our energy becomes much more expensive to get out of the ground, you know, Canadian tar sands, for example, then that might be a real constraint on growth. Now, is it possible to have a vibrant economy without growth? I think it's very difficult, partly because of this debt problem. If you have all this debt weighing on an economy and the economy isn't growing, then people are just not going to be able to pay it back. So you will have widespread defaults and frequent recessions. And so that's why taking on this debt, was particularly for Europe, was a mistake. It's like we've got to age 64 and we've got all this credit card debts and we're just about to retire. That wasn't sensible. We should have been more prudent in the past, and unfortunately we're not. And young people like Seth, who was on the phone before, they've been saddled with the bill.
And not only saddled with the bill, but also in many cases told that we're doing a bad thing by saving our money, that we ought to be putting our excess capital into the economy as opposed to into some kind of investment.
Yes, that's very difficult, isn't it? And there is, again, this shift in morality whereby savers are seen as bad for not spending money and supporting jobs. People are seen as predatory lenders if they lend at too high an interest rate. Germany is told off for being a good saver and, demanding its money back. It's very interesting. The problem is, with very low interest rates, and there's a good couple of columns in the last couple of days by Bill Gross, who's at PIMCO, and Charles Schwab, if you have very low interest rates, you need to save more if you want to save up for a pension, say. Hmm. If you're only getting 1% on your savings and you're targeting $200,000 or something, you're not going to get much of that $200,000 out of returns. You need more and more aside.
Philip Coggan is my guest this hour. He's Buttonwood columnist for The Economist and author of the new book Paper Promises, Debt, Money, and the New World Order. He'll be speaking to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth on Friday. You can find information at dfwworld.org. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes, and you can join us over the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is The Economist Buttonwood columnist Philip Coggan. His new book is called Paper Promises, Debt, Money, and the New World Order. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Philip, if we arrived at the present state of affairs, at least in part, after detaching from gold as a global currency anchor, is there any reason to entertain the notion of bringing back something like a gold standard?
Well, I understand why people like Ron Paul favor it, because the gold standard seemed to work quite well in Britain, at least for a couple of hundred years. So it delivered a long period of low inflation, and Britain became a dominant economic power while the gold standard was in place. But you have to think about why the gold standard was given up, which it was in the 1930s across the world. And it was because when you fix the value of money, everything else has to adjust. So take the example of Greece, which has essentially fixed its value of money by joining the euro. Greece can no longer devalue to get out of its debt problems. It has to cut its wages and prices 20 to 30% to deal with the issue. That is very hard to push through in a democratic society. And the gold standard, the classic period of the gold standard, was before these countries were really mass democracies. So it was essentially sort of upper middle class people who were making the decisions and voting, and those were the people with the money. Once you had mass democracies in the 1930s, and you started to get governments choose between austerity that hurt their voters and fixing the value of money relative to gold, they all chose to benefit their voters. And the idea now, I think, that you would fix the value of your currency relative to gold. Just like, look at all the problems that Greece has run in by fixing the value of its currency. I just don't see governments going for that, because governments will always want the ability to vary the amount of money to try and get them out of a crisis.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Gary on the line in Irving. Hi, Gary.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interesting program. I'd like to ask the guest to perhaps broaden his idea on the, I'll base it on the consumption of energy, and how is that going to play into the future monetary, the effects of our monetary plans in the future, because as we know, the world works on the basis of energy, and how is that going to play into the political situation of the monetary programs? Thanks
for your call.
I think that's a very good question. If you think about the world, it depends a lot on whether you're an energy producer or an energy consumer. So look at the countries which are doing extremely well. China is a slight exception to this, but Canada at the moment is doing well. Norway is doing well. You know, obviously the OPEC producers in the Middle East are very well off. And it used to be in the West that when we had a recession, oil price fell very sharply. Now, we've had a struggle in the last 3 years in the Western economy. And has the oil price fallen? No. Gas is, I don't know what it is in Texas, but let's say it's $3.50 a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oil prices have not come down. Now, why is that? That's because oil price is no longer determined by the amount of demand in America or Britain. It's determined by the amount of demand in China and in the developing world, where, of course, consumption is booming. So we have changed from being the oil price setter to being the oil price taker. And that means that essentially some of our wealth is being transferred to the oil producers. Now, in America, you're in a better position than in Europe because of the shale gas, and you have the potential to develop oil elsewhere. But it is a real struggle for those developed economies. It's like a tax on consumers that is coming in all the time when energy prices go up. And that's what makes it even more difficult to get out of a debt problem, because you're having to pay the energy producers as well as your creditors.
Let's go now on the phones to Wichita Falls, where we have Norm on the line. Hello, Norm. Hi, Norm.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Thank you. My question is, what would happen if the interest rates on loans by law was limited to no more, for example, than 5%? Would this not limit the creation of debt, which is our central problem? Thank you.
Well, you're right, Norm, it would. And if you go back in history, then in the Western world, for about 1,000 years, there were laws on usury which limited the amount of interest rates that could be paid on loans, and as a result of which, there wasn't very much debt. Now, a consequence of that, however, is that if you needed to borrow money and nobody wanted to lend to you money at 5%, you either couldn't get access to it, or you ended up having to borrow from shadier people who would be inclined not to prosecute you in a court, but come around with some the medieval equivalent of baseball bats and
break your kneecaps, right?
Yes, exactly. A lot of the lending, by limiting the amount of interest rates, a lot of lending shifts to sort of illegal practices. Now, the great problem as well is, if we've already got all this debt in issue. So what would you do about that debt if people are already facing 19%, you know, credit card rates, say? Would you shift those loans to 5%? And if you did, then probably credit card lenders would have to cut off credit to millions of consumers in America. Some of those credit card companies might even go bust. So you can see that clearly there are some people who charge way too much for loans. But logically speaking, people charge more to lend money because there's a risk involved to it. If you stop them charging that much, then they just won't lend, and thus lots of people won't get access to credit, and that would be a problem right now, certainly.
What do you see as the right balance between sort of technical solutions to our global financial problems right now and those that focus on public policy?
By technical solutions, Chris, you would think of what? What sort of things?
Well, I guess adjusting interest rates or adjusting the amount of debt that is owed or valuing currency in a different way.
Mm. I think the best thing to do, the public policy is really needed to grow the economy. So So what is needed to grow the economy? And I hesitate as an Englishman to give any advice to America, but you know, if you look at American infrastructure, is that absolutely perfect? Could it not be improved? The roads, the railways, things like that. Could education not be improved so that people come out of high school with better equipped to deal in a global economy where they're competing with China and India, which are churning out engineering graduates by the score? So that's the way. Now, none of those things turn the crisis around in the short run. But in the long run, if you get those things right, if people are better educated and the infrastructure is good, the economy will grow faster. So it's not so much about what the size of the deficit, it's what you're spending that money on, and perhaps the money needs to be directed, you know, more fruitfully to improving those key factors.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we speak with Ramez in Arlington. Hi, Ramez.
Yes, I've been hearing your program, and I've changed my original question because the gentleman just said that people charge high interest rates because there's the highest risk involved. Unfortunately, when you increase the interest rate to poor people, the chance of default increases just the same. So this argument seems to be a concocted argument just to make as much money off the poor as possible. And it just doesn't make any sense logically, in my opinion.
What do you think, Philip?
Well, the trouble there is, think of it from the point of view of yourself. Let's say you had one friend who was a prosperous person and another friend who was struggling, and you had to make a decision about which person to lend money to, you would probably favor the prosperous person because you'd be more certain of them paying you back. So the riskier the borrower, which usually means the less their wealth and assets, the more you have to worry that they won't pay you back. How do you compensate for them not paying, the risk of you not paying them back? Either not lend the money in the first place or charge more to reflect the fact that they might not pay the money back. I mean, this is as old a principle as finance itself. Unfortunately, it applies to individuals, it applies to companies, it applies to countries. That's why Greece is faced with sky-high rates on its loans. I wish there were a way around it. I mean, there are things in the developing world where you have microloans, where money is lent to poor people, particularly women, to encourage them to set up businesses. But they still charge, you know, reasonably significant interest rates. So unfortunately, it'd be lovely to think that you could lend poor people lots of money at a very low rate. But I don't think if history had found a way to do that, then they would have done so by now.
Coming back to the question we had earlier about having lost the old sort of morality tales about spending and saving and things like that, do you think that profligate spending by populations influences governments, or does it go the other way around, or is it even possible to sort of draw the line between those two things?
There's an economist in Chicago called Raghuram Rajan who has this wonderful phrase called let them eat credit, and his idea is that basically in the last 30, 40 years, as I probably know, Chris, the median wages of American workers have not gone up very much. Mm-hmm. So how have American workers got by? Well, they've got by perhaps because both parties in a marriage now go out to work when it used to be one. And secondly, because they borrowed money to keep their consumption up. And it's been a reasonably growing economy, so they've been happy to borrow money. But that process can't go on forever. So I think, you know, some people obviously been irresponsible, but a lot of people have borrowed money because that's what they had to do. And the difficulty now is, of course, it may be more difficult for them to get access to money, and more difficult if they lose their jobs, of course, to pay that money back. So one can be very immoral about it, but a lot of people have just done it because, you know, that was the only option they had.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Dan on the line in Dallas. Hey, Dan.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well, thanks.
Hey, you know, I think our biggest problem in this nation is the deficit, the federal deficit, and the money that we spend on interest paying, all of the debt financings that the country's relied on. Has any economist ever departed from the profit and loss statement and looked at the nation's balance sheet, the assets it has in land, buildings, mineral rights, et cetera, and perhaps capitalizing those into some sort of equity finance rather than debt to solve this deficit problem?
Yes, it's a very good point. We do tend to use debt which is a, what they call a stock in economics, as opposed to GDP, which is our annual income and expenditure, which is a flow. So it's a bit odd to compare the two. And if you were a company, you're absolutely right. You'd have a balance sheet and you'd value all the land in America and all the rest of it. But if you think about what you've just said, it would mean that instead of borrowing money from China in the form of treasury bonds, we would give China, say, you know, Yosemite or office buildings in Dallas or something in return for the loan. Now, I don't know how well that would go down with American voters. And China tried to buy an oil company a few years ago, and it was blocked on Congress in Congress. So the Japanese, remember, in the 1980s, they did start to pick up some sort of prime assets, but they were perhaps a less threatening presence in the economy than China would be if it started to buy large chunks of America. So that's the difficulty with it. And you're right, absolutely right to say, yes, there's a lot more wealth in America than there probably is debt. But the difficulty is, of course, it's not just the formal debt that America has. America's made all sorts of promises to its citizens in the form of pension benefits and healthcare spending, which will come in the future. And we'll need those assets to service those promises as well. And part of the theme of my book is, which is Paper Promises is the headline, not to plug it, but just to say there are paper promises in all sorts of ways. Money is a paper promise, debt's a paper promise, and we've made promises to our citizens, the government has, which, and some of those promises will be broken.
Does the symbiotic relationship between Chinese creditors and Western borrowers, does it increase the risk of violent conflict, or does it in some ways protect both sides from engaging in violent conflict to settle this?
I hope it reduces the conflict. I mean, the thing that slightly worries me about it is in 1956, Britain and France attacked Egypt to protect the Suez Canal, and America very quickly stepped in and told Britain to withdraw or else they would organize a run on the pound. And Britain withdrew very quickly. So that just shows the political power that a creditor can have over a debtor. So you can imagine in some future time, if there was a dispute over Taiwan, that it would add an interesting sort of frisson to the crisis if America started sending the fleet in and China started organizing a run on the dollar or on the treasury bond market. So I think there is a genuine point that political power generally shifts away from debtor nations and towards creditor nations. It happened to Spain all the way back in the 16th, 17th centuries. It happened to France. It happened to Britain. And it may happen to America in future.
We have very little time left, about 30 seconds. But what do you think, given the current realities, of the future of the Eurozone?
I think it's very difficult. Slow growth, many defaults by different countries, and a huge political dispute between Germany and the other struggling nations. One that will see many governments fall, as we've already seen several governments fall.
Philip Coggan is Buttonwood columnist for The Economist and former investment editor of the Financial Times. His new book is called Paper Promises, Debt, Money, and the New World Order. He'll be in town Friday for an address to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can find the details on that at dfwworld.org. Philip, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for giving us this hour.
Thank you very much, Chris, for having me on.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, you can email them to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.